"Excuse me," said Cuddy, prodding him in the knee. "Who's there?" "Down here."
Silverfish looked down. "Oh, are you a dwarf?"
Cuddy gave him a blank stare. "Are you a giant?" he said.
"Me? Oh, of course not."
"Ah, then I must be a dwarf, yes. And that's a troll behind me," said Cuddy.
Detritus pulled himself into something resembling attention.
"We've come to see if you can tell us what's on this paper," said Cuddy.
"Yeah," said Detritus.
Silverfish looked at it. "Oh, yes," he said. "Some of old Leonard's stuff. Well..."
"Leonard," said Cuddy. He glared at Detritus. "Write this down," he snapped.
"Leonard of Quirm," said the alchemist.
Cuddy still looked lost.
"Never heard of him?" said Silverfish.
"Can't say I have, sir.
I thought everyone knew about Leonard de Quirm. Quite balmy, but a genius, too."
"Was he an alchemist?"
"Write this down, write this down." Detritus looked around blearily for a burnt bit of wood and a handy wall. "Leonard? No, he didn't belong to a guild. Or he belonged to all the guilds, I suppose. He got around quite a bit. He tinkered, if you know what I mean."
"No, sir.
He painted a bit and messed about with mechanisms. Any old thing."
"Or a hammer and chisel, even," thought Detritus.
"This," said Silverfish, "is a formula for... well, I might as well tell you, it's hardly any big secret. It's a formula for what we call number one powder. Sulphur, saltpeter, and charcoal. You use it in fireworks. Any fool could make it up, but it looks odd because it's written back to front."
"This sounds important," hissed Cuddy to the troll.
"Oh, no. He always used to write back to front," said Silverfish. "He was odd like that, but very clever all the same. Haven't you seen his portrait of the Mona Og?"
"I don't think so."
Silverfish handed the parchment to Detritus, who squinted at it as if he knew what it meant. Maybe he could write on this, he thought. "The teeth followed you around the room. Amazing. In fact, some people said they followed them out of the room and all the way down the street."
"I think we should talk to Mr. de Quirm," said Cuddy.
"Oh, you could do that. You could do that, yes, certainly," said Silverfish. "But he might not be in a position to listen. He disappeared a couple of years ago."
"Then, when I find something to write with," thought Detritus, "I have to find someone to teach me how to write." "Disappeared? How?" said Cuddy.
"We think," said Silverfish, leaning closer, "that he found a way of making himself invisible."
"Really?"
"Because," said Silverfish, nodding conspiratorially, "no one's seen him."
"Ah," said Cuddy. "Ah, this is just off the top of my head, you understand, but I suppose he couldn't just have gone somewhere where you couldn't see him?"
"That wouldn't be like old Leonard. He wouldn't disappear, but he might vanish."
"Oh,
he was a bit unhinged, if you know what I mean. Head too full of brains. I remember he had this idea once of getting lightning out of lemons. Hey, Sendivoge, you remember Leonard and his lightning lemons?"
Sendivoge made little circular motions alongside his head with one finger.
"Oh, yes. If you stick copper and zinc rods in the lemon, hey presto, you get tame lightning. Man was an idiot."
"Not an idiot," said Silverfish, picking up a billiard ball that had miraculously escaped the detonations.
"Just so sharp he kept cutting himself, as my granny used to say. Lightning lemons. Where's the sense in that? It was as bad as his Voices in the Sky machine. I told him, Leonard, I said, what are wizards for, There's perfectly normal magic available for that kind of thing. Lightning lemons. It'll be men with wings next."
"And you know what he said? You know what he said? He said, funny you should say that. Poor old chap."
Even Cuddy joined in the laughter.
"And did you try it?" he said afterwards.
"Try what?" said Silverfish.
said Detritus, toiling behind the others.
"Putting the metal rods in the lemons. Don't be a damn fool."
"What's this letter mean?"
said Detritus, pointing at the paper. They looked.
"Oh, that's not a symbol," said Silverfish. "That's just old Leonard's way. He was always doodling in margins. Doodle, 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 I told him. You should call yourself Mr. Doodle."
"I thought it was some alchemy thing," said Cuddy. "It looks a bit like a crossbow without the bow. And this word, enoget, what does that mean?"
"Search me. Sounds barbarian to me." "Anyway, if that's all, officer, we've got some serious research to do," said Silverfish, tossing the fake ivory ball up in the air and catching it again. "We're not all daydreamers like poor old Leonard."
"Enoget," said Cuddy, turning the paper round and round. "T-H-E-G-O-N-N-E."
Silverfish missed the ball. Cuddy got behind Detritus just in time.
"I've done this before," said Sergeant Colan, as he and Nobby approached the Fool's Guild. "Keep up against the wall when I bangs the knocker, all right?"
It was shaped like a pair of artificial breasts, the sort that are highly amusing to rugby players and anyone whose sense of humour has been surgically removed. Colan gave it a quick rap and then flung himself to safety. There was a whoop, a few honks on a horn, a little tune that someone somewhere must have thought was very jolly. A small hatch slid aside above the knocker, and a custard pie emerged slowly on the end of a wooden arm. Then the arm snapped and the pie collapsed in a little heap by Colon's foot.
"It's sad, isn't it?" said Nobby.
The door opened awkwardly, but only by a few inches, and a small clown stared up at him.
"I say, I say, I say," it said. "Why did the fat man knock at the door?"
"I don't know," said Colon automatically. "Why did the fat man knock at the door?"
They stared at each other, tangled in the punchline.
"That's what I asked you," said the clown reproachfully.
He had a depressed, hopeless voice. Sergeant Colon struck out towards sanity.
"Sergeant Colon, night watch," he said. "And this here is Corporal Nobbs. We've come to talk to someone about the man who was found in the river, okay?"
"Oh, yes. Poor Brother Beano. I suppose you'd better come in, then," said the clown.
Nobby was about to push at the door when Colon stopped him and pointed wordlessly upwards.
"There seems to be a bucket of whitewash over the door," he said.
"Is there?" said the clown.
He was very small, with huge boots that made him look like a capital L. His face was plastered with flesh-coloured makeup, on which a big frown had been painted. His hair had been made from a couple of old mops painted red. He wasn't fat, but a sort of hoop in his trousers was supposed to make him look amusingly overweight. A pair of rubber braces, so that his trousers bounced up and down when he walked, were a further component in the overall picture of a complete and utter twerp.
"Yes," said Colon, "there is."
"Sure?"
"Positive."
"Sorry about that," said the clown. "It's stupid, I know, but kind of traditional. Wait a moment."
There were sounds of a stepladder being lugged into position and various clankings and swear words.
"All right, come on in."
The clown led the way through the gatehouse. There was no sound but the flop-flop of his boots on the cobbles. Then an idea seemed to occur to him.
"It's a long shot, I know, but I suppose neither of you gentlemen like a sniff of my buttonhole."
"No. No."
"No, I suppose not."
The clown sighed. "It's not easy, you know, clowning. I mean, I'm on gate duty because I'm on probation."
"You are?"
"I keep on forgetting. Is it crying on the outside and laughing on the inside? I always get it mixed up."
"About this Beano," Colon began.
"We're just holding his funeral," said the little clown. "That's why my trousers are at half-mast."
They stepped out into the sunlight again. The inner courtyard was lined with clowns and fools. Bells tinkled in the breeze. Sunlight glinted off red noses and the occasional nervous jet of water from a fake buttonhole. The clown ushered the guards into a line of fools.
"I'm sure Dr. Whiteface will talk to you as soon as we've finished," he said. "My name's Boffo, by the way."
He held out his hand, hopefully.
"Don't shake it," Colon warned.
Boffo looked crestfallen. A band struck up and a procession of guild members emerged from the chapel. A clown walked a little way ahead, carrying a small urn.
"This is very moving," said Boffo. On a dais on the opposite side of the quadrangle was a fat clown in baggy trousers, huge braces, a bow tie that was spinning gently in the breeze, and a top hat. His face had been painted into a picture of misery. He held a bladder on a stick. The clown with the urn reached the dais, climbed the steps, and waited. The band fell silent. The clown in the top hat hit the urn carrier about the head with the bladder. Once, twice, three times. The urn-bearer stepped forward, waggled his wig, took the urn in one hand and the clown's belt in the other, and with great solemnity poured the ashes of the late Brother Bino into the other clown's trousers. A sigh went up from the audience. The band struck up the clown anthem, The March of the Idiots, and the end of the trombone flew off and hit a clown on the back of the head. He turned and swung a punch at the clown behind him, who ducked, causing a third clown to be knocked through the bass drum. Colon and Nobby looked at one another and shook their heads. Boffo produced a large red-and-white handkerchief and blew his nose with a humorous honking sound. "Classic," he said, "is what he would have wanted."
"Have you any idea what happened?"
said Colon.
"Oh, yes. Brother Grinaldi did the old heel-and-toe trick and tipped the urn down—"
"I mean, why did Bino die?"
"We think it was an accident," said Boffo.
"An accident?" said Colon flatly.
"Yes, that's what Dr. Whiteface thinks."
Boffo glanced upwards briefly. They followed his gaze. The rooftops of the Assassin's Guild adjoined the Fool's Guild. It didn't do to upset neighbours like that, especially when the only weapon you had was a custard pie edged with short-crust pastry.
"That's what Dr. Whiteface thinks," said Boffo again, looking at his enormous shoes.
Sergeant Colon liked a quiet life, and the city could spare a clown or two. In his opinion, the loss of the whole boiling could only make the world a slightly happier place. And yet, honestly, he didn't know what had got into the watch lately. It was carrot, that's what it was. Even old Vimes had picked it up. We don't let things lie any more.
"Maybe he was cleaning a club sort of thing, and it accidentally went off," said Nobby.
He'd caught it too.
"No one would want to kill young Bino," said the clown in a quiet voice. "He was a friendly soul. Friends everywhere."
"Almost everywhere," said Colon.
The funeral was over. The jesters, jokers and clowns were going about their business, getting stuck in doorways on the way. There was much pushing and shoving and honking of noses and falling of prats. It was a scene to make a happy man slit his wrists on a fine spring morning.
"All I know is," said Boffo in a low voice, "that when I saw him yesterday he was looking very odd. I called out to him when he was going through the gates and—"
"How do you mean, odd?" said Colon.
"I'm detectoring," he thought, with a faint touch of pride. "People are helping me with my inquiries."
"Dunno. Odd. Not quite himself."
"This was yesterday?"
"Oh, yes, in the morning. I know, because the gate wrote to—"
"Yesterday morning?"
"That's what I said, mister. Mind you, we were all a bit nervous after the bang."
"Brother Boffo!"
"Oh, no," mumbled the clown.
A figure was striding towards them. A terrible figure. No clowns were funny, that was the whole purpose of a clown. People laughed at clowns, but only out of nervousness. The point of clowns was that after watching them, anything else that happened seemed enjoyable. It was nice to know there was someone worse off than you. Someone had to be the butt of the world. But even clowns are frightened of something. And that is the white-faced clown. The one who never gets in the way of the custard. The one in the shiny white clothes and the deadpan white makeup. The one with the little pointy hat and the thin mouth and the delicate black eyebrows.
Dr. Whiteface.
"Who are these gentlemen?" he demanded.
Boffo began.
"Night watch, sir," said Colon, saluting.
"And why are you here?"
"Investigating our inquiries as to the fatal demise of the clown Bino, sir," said Colon.
"I rather think this is guild business, sergeant, don't you?"
"Well, sir, he was found in the ri—"
"I'm sure it is something we don't need to bother the watch with," said Dr. Whiteface.
Colon hesitated. He'd prefer to face Dr. Cruces than this apparition. At least the assassins were supposed to be unpleasant. Clowns were only one step away from mime artists, too.
"No, sir," he said. "It was obviously an accident, right?"
"Quite so. Brother Boffo will show you to the door," said the head clown. "And then," he added, "he will report to my office. Does he understand?"
"Yes, Dr. Whiteface," mumbled Boffo.
"What'll he do to you?"
said Nobby as they headed for the gate.
"Hat full of whitewash, probably," said Boffo. "Pie in a face if I'm lucky."
He opened the wicket gate.
"A lot of us ain't happy about this," he whispered. "I don't see why those buggers should get away with it. We ought to go round to the assassins and have it out with them."
"Why the assassins?" said Colon. "Why would they kill a clown?"
Boffo looked guilty. "I never said a thing."
Colon glared at him.
"There is definitely something odd happening, Mr. Boffo."
Boffo looked around as if expecting a vengeful custard pie at any moment.
"You find his nose," he hissed. "You just find his nose. His poor nose."
The gate slammed shut. Sergeant Colon turned to Nobby.
"Did Exhibit A have a nose, Nobby?"
"Yes, Fred."
"Then what was that about?"
"Search me."
Nobby scratched a promising boil.
"Perhaps he meant a false nose, you know, those red ones on elastic. The ones," said Nobby, grimacing, "they think are funny. He didn't have one."
Colon rapped on the door, taking care to stand out of the way of any jolly amusing booby traps. The hatch slid open.
"Yes," hissed Boffo.
"Did you mean his false nose?" said Colon.
"His real one. Now bugger off."
The hatch snapped back.
"Mental," said Nobby firmly.
"Beano had a real nose. Did it look wrong to you?" said Colon.
"No, it had a couple of holes in it."
"Well, I don't know about noses," said Colon, "but either Brother Boffo is dead wrong or there's something fishy going on."
"Like what?"
"Well, Nobby, you're what I might call a career soldier, right?"
"That's right, Freight."
"How many dishonourable discharges have you had?"
"Lots," said Nobby proudly, "but I always puts a poultice on them."
"You've been on a lot of battlefields, haven't you?"
"Dozens."
Sergeant Colon nodded. "So you've seen a lot of corpses, right, when you've been ministering to the fallen?" Corporal Nobbs nodded. They both knew that ministering meant harvesting any personal jewellery and stealing their boots. In many a faraway battlefield, the last thing many a mortally wounded foreman ever saw was Corporal Nobbs heading towards him with a sack, a knife, and a calculating expression.
"Shame to let good stuff go to waste," said Nobby.
"So you've noticed how dead bodies get to..."
"Deader,"
said Sergeant Colon.
"Deader than dead?"
"You know, more corpsey," said Sergeant Colon, forensic expert.
"Going stiff and purple and such like?"
"Right."
"And then sort of manky and runny?"
"Yes, yes, all right."
"It makes it easier to get the rings off, mind you.
The point is, Nobby, that you can tell how old a corpse is. That clown, for E.G., you saw him same as me. How long would you say?"
"About 5'9", I'd say. His boots didn't fit, I know that. Too floppy."
"I meant, how long had he been dead?"
"Couple of days. You can tell because there's this..."
"So how come Boffo saw him yesterday morning?" They strolled onwards.
"Bit of a poser, that is," said Nobby. "You're right. I expect the captain will be very interested."
"Maybe he was a zombie."
"I shouldn't think so. Never could stand zombies," Nobby mused.
"Really?
It was always so hard to nick their boots."
Sergeant Colon nodded at a passing beggar.
"You still doing the folk dancing on your nights off, Nobby?"
"Yes, Fred. We're practising gathering sweet lilacs this week. There is a very complicated double crossover step."
"You're definitely a man of many parts, Nobby."
"If only I could cut the rings off, Fred. What I mean is, you present an intriguing dichotomy."
Nobby took a kick at a small, scruffy dog.
"You been reading books again, Fred?"
"Got to improve my mind, Nobby. It's these new recruits. Carrot's got his nose in a book half the time. Angua knows words I has to look up. Even the short ass is brighter than me. They keep on extracting the urine. I'm definitely a bit under-endowed in the head department."
"You're brighter than detritus," said Nobby.
"That's what I tell myself. I say, Fred, whatever happens, you're brighter than detritus. But then I say, Fred, so's yeast."
He turned away from the window. So, The damn watch. That damn Vimes. Exactly the wrong man in the wrong place. Why didn't people learn from history? Treachery was in his very genes. How could a city run properly with someone like that poking around? That wasn't what a watch was for. Watchmen were supposed to do what they were told and see to it that other people did too. Someone like Vimes could upset things. Not because he was clever. A clever watchman was a contradiction in terms. But sheer randomness might cause trouble. The gun lay on the table. What shall I do about Vimes?
Kill him.
Angua woke up. It was almost noon. She was in her own bed at Mrs. Cake's, and someone was knocking at the door.
"Hmm?"
she said.
"I don't know. Shall I ask him to go away?"
said a voice from around the keyhole level. Angua thought quickly. The other residents had warned her about this. She waited for her cue.
"Oh, thanks, love. I was forgetting," said the voice.
You had to pick your time with Mrs. Cake. It was difficult living in a house run by someone whose mind was only nominally attached to the present. Mrs. Cake was a psychic.
"You've got your precognition switched on again, Mrs. Cake,"
said Angua, swinging her legs out of bed and rummaging quickly through the pile of clothes on the chair.
"Where'd we got to?"
said Mrs. Cake, still on the other side of the door.
"You just said, 'I don't know, shall I ask him to go away, Mrs. Cake?'" said Angua. Clothes, that was always the trouble. At least a male werewolf only had to worry about a pair of shorts and pretend he'd been on a brisk run.
"Right," Mrs. Cake coughed. "There's a young man downstairs asking for you," she said.
"Who is it?"
said Angua. There was a moment's silence.
"Yes, I think that's all sorted out," said Mrs. Cake. "Sorry, dearie, I get terrible headaches if some people don't fill in the right bits. Are you human, dear?"
More usually, a landlady would ask, "Are you decent?" But Mrs. Cake knew her lodgers.
"You can come in, Mrs. Cake."
It wasn't much of a room. It was mainly brown. Brown oilcloth flooring, brown walls, a picture over the brown bed of a brown stag being attacked by brown dogs on a brown moorland against a sky which, contrary to established meteorological knowledge, was brown. There was a brown wardrobe. Possibly, if you fought your way through the mysterious old coats, brown, hanging in it, you'd break through into a magical fairyland full of talking animals and goblins. But it'd probably not be worth it. Mrs. Cake entered. She was a small, fat woman, but made up for her lack of height by wearing a huge black hat. Not the pointy witch variety, but one covered with stuffed birds, wax fruit, and other assorted decorative items, all painted black. Angua quite liked her. The rooms were clean and brown. The rates were cheap, and Mrs. Cake had a very understanding approach to people who lived slightly unusual lives and had, for an example, an aversion to garlic. Her daughter was a werewolf, and she knew all about the need for ground floor windows and doors with long handles that a paw could operate.
"He's got chain mail on," said Mrs. Cake. She was holding a bucket of gravel in either hand. "He's got soap in his ears, too."
"Oh, right.
"I can tell him to bugger off if you like," said Mrs. Cake. "That's what I always do if the wrong sort comes around. Especially if they've got a stake. I can't be having with them sort of thing people messing up the hallways, waving torches and stuff."
"I think I know who it is," said Angua. "I'll see to it." She tucked in her shirt.
"Pull the door to if you go out," Mrs. Cake called after her as she went out into the hall. "I'm just off to change the dirt in Mr. Winkin's coffin on account of his back giving him trouble."
"It looks like gravel to me, Mrs. Cake."
"Orthopaedic, see?"
Carrot was standing respectfully on the doorstep with his helmet under his arm and a very embarrassed expression on his face.
"Well," said Angua, not unkindly. Good morning. I thought, you know, perhaps you not knowing very much about the city, really, I could, if you like, if you don't mind, not having to go on duty for a while, show you some of it."
For a moment, Angua thought she'd contracted prescience from Mrs. Cake. Various futures flitted across her imagination.
"I haven't had breakfast," she said. "They make a very good breakfast in Gimlet's Dwarf Delicatessen in Cable Street." "It's lunchtime."
"It's breakfast time for the night watch."
"I'm practically vegetarian."
"He does a Sawyer rat," she gave in.
"I'll fetch my coat."
said a voice full of withering cynicism. She looked down. Gaspard was sitting behind Carrot, trying to glare while scratching himself furiously.
"Last night we chased a cat up a tree," said Gaspard. "You and me, eh? We could make it. Fate has thrown us together, style of thing."
"Go away."
"Sorry?" said Carrot. "Not you, that dog." Carrot turned. "Him? Is he bothering you now? He's a nice little chap."
"Woof, woof, Biscuit."
Carrot automatically patted his pocket.
"See," said Gaspard, "this boy is Mr. Simple, am I right?"
"Do they let dogs in dwarf shops?" said Angua. "No," said Carrot.
"On a hook," said Gaspard.
"Really? Sounds good to me," said Angua. "Let's go."
"Vegetarian," mumbled Gaspard, limping after them. "Oh, my."
"Shut up." "Sorry," said Carrot. "I was just thinking aloud."
Vimes's pillow was cold and hard. He felt it gingerly. It was cold and hard because it was not a pillow but a table. His cheek appeared to be stuck to it, and he was not interested in speculating what with. He hadn't even managed to take his armour off. But he did manage to unstick one eye. He'd been writing in his notebook, trying to make sense of it all, and then he'd gone to sleep. What time was it? No time to look back. He traced out, "Stolen from Assassin's Guild, gone, dash, Hammerhock killed, smell of fireworks, lump of lead, alchemical symbols, second body in river, a clown, where was his red nose, gone." He stared at the scrawled notes. "I'm on the path," he thought. "I don't have to know where it leads, I just have to follow. There's always a crime if you look hard enough, and the assassins are in this somewhere. Follow every lead, check every detail, chip, chip away. I'm hungry." He staggered to his feet and looked at his face in the cracked mirror over the basin. Events of the previous day filtered through the clogged gauze of memory. Central to them all was the face of Lord Vetinari. Vimes grew angry just thinking about that. The cool way he'd told Vimes that he mustn't take an interest in the theft from... Vimes stared at his reflection. Something stung his ear and smashed the glass. Vimes stared at the hole in the plaster, surrounded by the remains of a mirror frame. Around him, the mirror glass tinkled to the floor. Vimes stood stock still for a long moment. Then his legs, reaching the conclusion that his brain was somewhere else, threw the rest of him to the floor. There was another tinkle, and a half bottle of Bear Huggers exploded on the desk. Vimes couldn't even remember buying it. He scrambled forward on hands and knees and pulled himself upright alongside the window. Images flashed through his mind. The dead dwarf. The hole in the wall. A thought seemed to start in the small of his back and spread upwards to his brain. These were lath and plaster walls, and old ones at that. You could push a finger through them with a bit of effort. As for a lump of metal, he hit the floor at the same time as a pock coincided with a hole punched through the wall on one side of the window. Plaster dust puffed into the air. His crossbow was leaning against the wall. He wasn't an expert, but hells, who was? You pointed it and you fired it. He pulled it towards him, rolled on his back, stuck his foot in the stirrup and hauled on the string until it clicked into place. Then he rolled back onto one knee and slotted a quarrel into the groove. A catapult, that's what it was. It had to be. Troll-sized, perhaps. Someone up on the roof of the opera house or somewhere high. Draw their fire, draw their fire. He picked up his helmet and balanced it on the end of another quarrel. The thing to do was crouch below the window and... He thought for a moment. Then he shuffled across the floor to the corner, where there was a pole with a hook on the end. Once upon a time it had been used to open the upper windows, now long rusted shut. He balanced his helmet on the end, wedged himself into the corner, and with a certain amount of effort moved the pole so that the helmet just showed over the windowsill. Pock! Splinters flew up from a point on the floor, where it would undoubtedly have severely inconvenienced anyone lying on the boards cautiously raising a decoy helmet on a stick. Vimes smiled. Someone was trying to kill him, and that made him feel more alive than he had done for days. And they were also slightly less intelligent than he was. This is a quality you should always pray for in your would-be murderer. He dropped the pole, picked up the crossbow, spun past the window, fired at an indistinct shape on the opera house roof opposite as if the bow could possibly carry across that range, leapt across the room, and wrenched at the door. Something smashed into the doorframe as the door swung to behind him. Then it was down the back stairs, out of the door, over the privy roof, into Knuckle Passage, up the back steps of Zorgo the retrophrenologist, into Zorgo's operating room, and over to the window. It works like this. Phrenology, as everyone knows, is a way of reading someone's character, aptitude and abilities by examining the bumps and hollows on their head. Therefore, according to the kind of logical thinking that characterises the Ankh-Morpork mind, it should be possible to mould someone's character by giving them carefully graded bumps in all the right places. You can go into a shop and order an artistic temperament with a tendency to introspection and a side order of hysteria. What you actually get is hit on the head with a selection of different size mallets. But it creates employment and keeps the money in circulation, and that's the main thing. Zorgo and his current patient looked at him curiously. Pugnant's roof was empty. Vimes turned back and met a pair of puzzled gazes.
Morning, Captain Vimes,
said the retrophrenologist, a hammer still upraised in one massive hand. Vimes smiled manically.
Just thought, he began, and then went on, I saw an interesting rare butterfly on the roof over there.
Troll and patient stared politely past him.
But there wasn't, said Vimes. He walked back to the door. Sorry to have bothered you, he said, and left.
Zorgo's patient watched him go with interest.
Didn't he have a crossbow? He said. Bit odd going after interesting rare butterflies with a crossbow.
Zorgo readjusted the fit of the grid on his patient's bald head.
Dunno, he said. I suppose it stops them creating all those damn thunderstorms.
He picked up the mallet again.
Now, what were we going for today? Decisiveness, yes?
Yes. Well, no. Maybe.
Right. Zorgo took aim. This, he said with absolute truth, won't hurt a bit.